Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. We got this. Yeah, we still got Team Supreme with us. Yeah. What's up, Leia? How are you?
Doing good. Doing good from the east, from the East Coast. Doing well. Looking forward to this. Yeah.
Wait, you're in the East Coast?
Yes, I'm doing. I told you it's the vaccinated visit, buddy. Everybody's vaccinated. Yes, mama, daddy, everybody.
Welcome back. Welcome back home. That's nice.
Thank you.
Unpaid bill. You okay?
I'm also vaccinated. I feel fantastic. Everything's good.
All right, Fontigolo, you cool?
I'm good, man. Enjoying some grilled chicken and a salad.
Nice.
Not trying to live better, you know?
Yeah. Right. I'm on day 12 of salad. Just salad. What's up, Steve? How's it going?
I'll be the only honest one here and say I am stressed out. Let's do this anyway. Everybody lying.
I know, I want to get this done. No, we're not stressed out. We're putting good vibrations out there. I will say that our distinguished guests are the founding members of the legendary Grammy Award-winning Fifth Dimension. Of course, during the mid-70s, our guests left the group and paired down to a duo, released several Grammy-caliber songs like the Inescapable, You Don't Have to Be a Star to Be My Show, Your Love, I Hope We Get to Love in Time, Shine on Silver Moon, plenty others, 7 Grammy nominations in total. I would actually paraphrase and say that they are Jay and Beyonce are the Billy and Merle McCoo of now, not the opposite, that they are the Jay and Beyonce.
Yes.
For real.
They are absolute happiness and joy. I consider them the first couple of pop and soul. Their marriage has been strong for 50 plus years, I believe. 52nd coming this July is your anniversary.
Right. Yeah,
that is amazing, and wow. They're still releasing music, ladies and gentlemen, which is incredible. They released a new collection of Lennon McCartney compositions, aptly titled Blackbird, songs that were inspired by the turbulent experiences that we've been through in the last year or so in 2020. What else can I say? Oh, not to mention, they are a vital part of the, I hear it's an excellent documentary called Suburban Soul about
Rumor has
Cultural Festival 1969. I hear it's good, you know, anyway.
Rumor.
Ladies and gentlemen, please.
I hear this is the week it comes out, too.
Oh, really? It comes out this week?
I hear it comes out this week.
That's amazing. All right, cool. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the legendary Billy Davis Jr. and Marilyn McCoo to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you, Quest.
Yes. So glad to be here with you all.
Listen, you said you heard about the documentary being good. You heard right.
Ah, see, okay. I'm gonna go see it.
Flowers.
I gotta see it for myself.
Receive and your flowers.
Also, all those things you said about us, how much do we owe you?
No. I owe you guys. I really, really, really do love you guys. Actually, you know what? That one story I know a lot about you guys, but can you guys describe, I know that you guys were acquaintances before you got married, of course, like no one starts off being married and then starts, you know, with friends. Can you guys describe the first time that you met each other? Do you guys remember the first day you met each other?
I don't
remember the first day you met each other? Oh, it's like the newlywed game. This was to hit him on the head with the...
Well, don't forget, it was 50-something years.
Okay.
And I was drinking.
Oh, yeah. Now what are you trying to say?
Wait a minute, baby. Come on.
Gotta keep it spicy. Yeah. Right.
I was drunk when we got married. I was never going to speak to him again. And guess what? I was walking down the aisle, and I looked into his face, and I saw red eyes.
Uh-oh. Shots fired.
Bachelor party was okay. I get it.
So you remember up to that.
Right.
You remember up to that point. Okay.
Before we met, I had been hearing about this guy from St. Louis because Lamont McLemore from the group and Ron Townsend from the group were all from St. Louis, and they were talking about this guy named Junebug, who was coming out from St. Louis looking for a record deal and that he could sing.
Right. And that's Junebug, I see.
That's
so, so you're not from St. Louis?
Who, me? Yes, I am.
No.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
no, Ms. McCoo, I,
St. Louis. Yeah,
that was okay. In the group. Yeah, so the group was formed by, and we should also note that Ron
Lamont McLemore. Oh,
I'm not Ron. I'm sorry. Lamont McLemore is
Beauty of the Week, baby.
The legendary.
They what now?
Beauty of the Week. Jet Beauty of the Week. Page 42.
He's the man. Godin.
He's a photographer or something.
He was the original Instagram.
Shut up.
Yes.
Oh, still, y'all just
even to like whenever Jet went around, I don't know when Jet stopped
jetting
his publication, but he went to the very end. So yes,
right.
Shouts out.
Right. Lamont took all the pictures of it, not all of them, but most of the pictures of that the women in the bathing suits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the middle of Jet.
Yes, I know the Beauty of the Week.
Mm-hmm. He even that had was my that childhood. Study career, even at the height of Fifth Dimensiondom. Like,
right, he was still doing that. Yeah,
how can one juggle both and still and still do that? I'm also in the mind state that once you're in the Fifth Dimension, you're touring all over, like 9 months out the year. But he was able to maintain both on a weekly basis.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, he would. I don't know just how his setup was, but okay. He was definitely still doing it, you know, and still making our rehearsals. And sometimes when we would be out of town, he would be off, and we had a day off or something. He would find some young lady to shoot, you know, take out somewhere and shoot her, you know.
And he was his own agent. That's incredible.
Yes, oh, yes, yes. Yes.
one of the running jokes. Anytime that you guys were on any show was finding Lamont a wife. That's always been like the running joke in any Fifth Dimension interview. Like, was this bachelorhood like legendary in the '70s? Like
pretty legendary.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yes.
Did he eventually get married?
Yes, he did.
He's been married for a number of years now. Yes.
Okay. I was about to say. No, just based on my Fifth Dimension research, like every time that was like a running joke. Did he get married yet? Is he still a bachelor? Okay, I get it now.
Well, Lamont was always the one in the male in the group that always had these long range plans with these young ladies. You know, he would meet a young lady and he always tell her, well, I got some long range plans for her. You know, so that's why we always tease him about getting married. He was always waiting, but he finally did get married. Yes.
Okay. What year did the group officially form? I know that you guys were under the name the Versatiles. It was the Versatiles, correct?
That's right.
That's the way we started. Yes. Yes, and that was in 1965.
And then why was it changed to the Fifth Dimension?
Well, we were getting ready to come out with this song with our first single, and the man who was the head of the record company thought that the Versatile sounded kind of old, that we needed something edgy and new. And so we all went home, and we were supposed to come back with creative ideas for a new name for the group. And okay. Ron Townsend and his wife came up with the name The Fifth Dimension. And when we first heard it, everybody loved it. And we voted on it because we voted on everything in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And Fifth Dimension won out hands down.
Was there like sort of a cosmic kind of definition? Was it supposed to intentionally be like psychedelic because of what the times were during that period? Or
yeah, pretty much. You know, we were five members of a group.
And I think Ronaldman was talking about dimensions.
Dimensions,
sound dimension.
Yeah.
And,
well, they decided that the Fifth Dimension was supposed
to be sound.
The Fifth Dimension was sound. So yeah. We said, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I see. Did you guys at all, I know that Bell Records was a label closely associated with Arthur Shimkin. And also with, I believe Clive Davis started or at least worked there at that time period. Did you guys work with him at all or have any dealings with him? Or was he at Columbia by this point?
actually, we didn't work with.
We did work with Clive, but just for a minute. You know, actually, Soul City was the name of the label, and that was the one that started the group.
Yeah.
And then when Bell Records came in, Larry Utall
was the president.
Do you remember that name?
Yeah, I know that name. Yes.
Yeah, Larry Utall actually started Bell Records. And the Fifth Dimension was still there.
Right.
And then some transitions took place, and Clive Davis came in.
And when he came in, he turned it into Arista, correct?
Right.
Yes,
exactly.
That's what happened. Right.
Oh, okay. I see now.
I think one of the guys at Bell Records was Irv Beagle, wasn't it?
Irv Beagle. Yes.
Yeah.
He worked with Clive.
He worked with Larry Utall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the very beginning. Yeah.
In the beginning of the group, who decided the direction? Because you guys had a really somewhat sophisticated, elegant sound. Sort of a step ahead of, I guess at the time, like Motown was the leader of a more classier version of soul. But you guys were definitely kind of a step ahead of that. Like, who decided the direction of the group, and how do you guys approach your creativity?
Well, one of the things that happened is when we first started the group and called ourselves the Versatiles. Uh-huh. Well, we did that because we were all different. All of us were different singers. I was more gospel, R&B, blues. Marilyn was more pop, and Ronald was more operatic sounding. Florence was more pop, and Lamont was more of a bass kind of singer and more of a pop singer. So when we decided, when we started as the Versatiles, we went into it as more of a jazz kind of opportunity to create different types of music. Mm-hmm. But when we got signed with Johnny Rivers, we carried that sound with us right on into the record company. And so when he suggested that we do Go Where You Wanna Go, and we said, well, from the Mamas and Papas, that was a cover for us. And we said, well, it's not going to sound like Motown. You know, we were into what was happening for Brothers and Sisters, you know.
Right.
And even though we know we had a different sound, that was the kind of music we were looking for. But he said, no, let's try this. It'll be a hit. And when he said it'll be a hit, well, everybody was looking for a hit. You know, every artist want a hit, even if it's Pop Goes the Weasels, you know.
Right.
we want a hit, you know. So
jam.
We did Go Where You Want to Go, and it came out with more of a soulful sound, but not like the Pop Mamas and Papas, but it created a sound.
Okay, I see that. I got to say that because of my weird obsession with the song MacArthur's Park, I know that was written by Jimmy Webb.
Yeah.
And if you kind of look at his catalog,
Wichita Lineman.
Yeah, like Wichita Lineman and all that stuff. Like, it's like really weird, unorthodox songs. And uh-huh. I know that he wrote Up, Up, and Away.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So, like, at the time when you were approached, how did that song come into the sphere of the Fifth Dimension, and what was the deciding factor that, okay, this fits us? Because it's kind of, even though it's a hit, it's a really very weird, specific song. Like, we're going to sing about balloons, air balloons, or whatever. Like, how did you guys come across that song?
Well, you know, Mark Gordon, who was the group's manager, introduced Johnny Rivers, who was the owner of Soul City Records, to okay. Jimmy Webb, because he was saying, we need somebody creative and new and different. And Mark had worked with Motown Records and had left Motown. And it's a long story about how we all met, but he liked the group. He liked our direction. And he said that he wanted to manage us. So when he was talking to Johnny Rivers, and Johnny said, we need somebody young, new, different. Mark said, there's a very talented young man who was trying to get some of his songs recorded at Motown. Mm-hmm. His name is Jimmy Webb. I'd like for you to meet him. And so they met, and we ended up working together on our first album, mm-hmm. which was called Go Where You Want to Go. Well, right. Actually, it ended up being called, up, away.
Up, up, and away.
Right.
Okay. And so we were working on some music, and there was a hot air balloon festival that took place down in Palm Springs on over a weekend. And Jimmy went down to that festival, and he came back so inspired by what he had seen that he wrote a song. And he wrote this song called Up, Up, and Away, talking about the balloons.
Right.
And mm-hmm. So he played the song for the group, and we said, oh, man, that's a wonderful song. You know, it's a happy feeling. It makes everybody want to dance.
And feel good.
Feel really good.
Right.
It'll never be a hit.
Oh, yeah, I just thought it was going to be filler, like just an album cut.
Right. It was all, we thought, well, you know, we were still listening, waiting for some Motown stuff, you know. Right. Come up with Up, Up, and Away. We say, hey, man, that'll never be a hit, you know. And come to find out, it was a big smash for
huge
us.
Huge for us.
And it won us, what, 4, 5 Grammys?
Well, we won 4 Grammys. Yeah. And then Bones Howe. Well, no, Bones wasn't a producer on that. Yeah. Mark
won
and
a Grammy. Yeah.
Mark and Johnny Rivers and, won production yeah, Grammys. Right. And Jimmy Webb won it for the song.
Songwriting. Yeah.
Now, I remember you guys previously telling me before that when you guys won the Grammy for the song, that you weren't too sure like how important the Grammys were, like, or if it was a big deal. Like in the late 60s, were the Grammys as big of a prestige thing as we hold it now? Or was it just like, oh, that's nice, we won a Grammy. What's a Grammy?
Exactly.
That's what we thought.
Well, at that time, the Grammys weren't being televised.
No.
So the record company was so excited. Oh, you all have been nominated for Grammys. And we said, that is so cool. What's a Grammy?
Grammy.
Yeah, we didn't even know what it was, you know. And but after we won the first Grammy and got behind all that excitement, the next one, we were in line for it. We were ready for it, you know.
Oh, okay.
We were going for Grammys, you know.
I see. You guys mentioned Mark Gordon, because I'm like a fan / aficionado of Soul Train. I know that oftentimes, like if Al Wilson was on the show, Don would talk to Mark, or he was there, I think, during the Staple Singers episode as well. So, like, I'm familiar with Mark Gordon. Mm-hmm. The thing was, I didn't know that he was married to Florence LaRue during that time period, but I was also shocked for you guys to go to the levels and the heights that you've gone to. Even in my mind, I thought, wow, they really had a powerful white manager.
Uh-huh.
How was it that Mark was able to work his magic as a manager? And, you know, he's managed everyone, like, name it, like Tony. This also probably explains why you and Tony Orlando and Dawn also had your variety shows. Like, what was Mark like as a manager that he had like further reach than your average manager, where he can get his acts even past mainstream, but just in spaces where you normally don't see black acts?
Well, Mark had a lot, you know. Mark came again from the Motown background, and so I'm sure he learned a lot when he was there. And he was running the West Coast office mm-hmm. of Motown Records,
okay.
And that's how we met him. And he was also a producer, and so we were hoping that maybe he would produce a record on the group, and we would end up at Motown. But again, for one reason or another, that Mark and Motown agreed to disagree, mm-hmm. and so Mark came and said, I'd like to manage you guys. I like your idea. I like the sound that you have, and I think I can do something with you. And then he and Johnny Rivers, who was more of a country singer, mm-hmm. had some major hits, but he loved R&B and he wanted to produce some R&B music. So he came to Mark and he said, why don't we co-produce some projects together? And so that was how they ended up producing us. And that was how we ended up recording Go Where You Want to Go and then Up, Up, and Away. And Mark introduced Johnny to Jimmy Webb. So Mark was a visionary in so many ways.
He was definitely a good manager. And I think the popularity of the group is what kind of got him in the position to be able to open the doors, because don't forget, he was our personal manager, but we also had an agency
that was
opening doors to, like William Morris. You know, with our popularity, we were going pop, you know.
Y'all had the best of the best.
Yes, and we were right in the middle of that. So all the doors were opening for the Ed Sullivan shows and all of the white shows that was happening. They wanted to fit the mention. So
what was it ever a struggle? Okay, so one of the career highlights for most black acts that I've spoken to, especially that have starred in the 60s, most of them were being groomed to play the Copa. That was like one thing is surviving the Apollo. The other thing is being able to play the Copa, which, you know, I can only imagine that was a prestigious thing. Was that necessarily a goal for this particular group, or was that not kind of in your radar?
Everybody wanted to play the Copa.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to play the Copa. But what happened was there was another club in New York.
Well, actually, it was a club, but it was a room.
Yes.
At the Americana Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Royal Box.
The Royal Box. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And they ended up hiring us, and we would work the Royal Box every year, right during prom season. You know, so they knew that the Fifth Dimension would pack that place every year. So it was for 3 or 4 years straight. That's where we were at. So I guess the Copa, once they knew we were at the Royal Box, they never tried to book us.
Oh, okay.
So wow. We blew our chance by working at the Royal Box. But you know what? It was great because of the Royal Box, that's how we ended up with finding
Aquarius.
Aquarius sent the sunshine in.
Okay, so I know this legendary story, and it's definitely one of the highlights of Summer of Soul. Could you please share with our audience the circumstances that actually led you to recording The Age of Aquarius, Let the Sunshine In?
And this is a show enough true story.
Right.
I can't believe it, but it's amazing.
People think we made it up a stage, but you can't make up nothing like this, you know?
No, you can't. No, you can't.
We were working in New York, and the funny thing is that I went out to shop, and coming back, getting out of the cab, I lost my wallet and it fell in the cab. So I came upstairs in the hotel room, and I told Marilyn, I was looking in my pocket. I said, "Baby, I lost my wallet." And Marilyn said, "Oh, well, you can forget that. You're in New York. You ain't gonna never see that wallet no more." I said, "Oh." Right. And so about an hour after that, I got a phone call, and the guy said, "Is this Billy Davis Jr.?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "I got your wallet."
Wow.
A wallet. And I got all excited because he had found my wallet. And I told him, I said, "Well, just hold on to it. I'm coming to your house and get it." So I went to his house and I offered him some money. He didn't want the money. So I invited him to come and see us at the Royal Box.
Okay.
Perform. So he took us up on that. So after the show, he came to the show, him and his wife. And after the show, he came backstage and he said, "Man, you guys are beautiful. It's wonderful. I love the show." He said, "Since you were so nice, Billy, I'd like to invite you to see our show." I said, "What show?" Come to find out, he was one of the producers of Hair.
Right.
Right. Wow.
He had been trying to get in to see Hair for I don't know how long. No seats. It was like the Hamilton of
Hamilton with skin.
There were lions trying to get in to see Hair. Right. It was the first time they ever seen people naked on stage, you know.
Right.
So everybody was dashing, you know. But we finally got in. He invited us over to see it, and we saw this young kid by the name of Ronnie Dyson singing Aquarius. And when he filled the auditorium with that beautiful voice of his.
Yes.
And when he did that, we all heard it right then and said, "We have to do that song. That's a Fifth Dimension song."
It's going to be a hit.
It's going to be a hit. That's what was the first time we ever said that. It's going to be a hit. And sure enough, it was the biggest record that we had ever recorded.
That's amazing.
Wait, so how did it go from the stage to your song, though, with that strain, with the producer?
Like, we called our producer, who was Bones Howe.
Yeah.
And we said, Bones. And I mean, everybody, when we got together at intermission, we were all five of us in said, agreement. This is going to be a hit. So we called Bones and said, Bones, we found our next hit. And he said, what's that? And we said,
Aquarius.
He said, well, I don't know. He said, there's a lot of people that have tried to make a hit out of that song and it hasn't worked.
Okay.
And we said, but the Fifth Dimension didn't sing it, you know. So we were so determined to record that song. So he said, well, let me listen to it some more and see what we can come up with. So then he came back to us a little while later, a couple of weeks later, and he said, I think I have an idea of how to make this work. And he came up with the idea of taking Aquarius and putting it together with another song.
Let the Sunshine In.
Let the Sunshine In.
Yes, Let the Sunshine In, which was from the song called Flesh Failures. Flesh Failures,
right.
And by combining the two of those together, we ended up with the biggest hit of our careers.
Yeah.
Oh, so Let the Sunshine In was not a part of Hair. I didn't know that. Okay.
Well,
yeah,
yes.
It was a part of Hair.
It was a part of Hair.
Oh.
Put together.
It didn't sound
like the odd part, what we did with Let the Sunshine In.
As a matter of fact, the way that they did it in the show was that let the sunshine.
Yeah, it was one of those.
Or real slow and, okay.
The sunshine, and it was a sad song.
Right.
But Bones came up with the idea of making it more joyous. And then when we were in the studio recording it, then he said, okay, the group was singing it like, let the sunshine. Then he says, okay, Billy, now go and take it to church, man.
Wow. That's what I was going to say, yes.
Yes.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. On an average, how many gigs, what, just from a touring standpoint, I know touring from more or less like doing 5 straight months, like living on the road, never coming home, like after 5 straight months or whatever. But could you describe to us, like, what was the gig circuit like during that time in around 1969 for the group? Like, how many, was it mainly just one-nighters, or was it, you know, concentrated time in America, then you go to other parts of the world? Like, what was the average touring season like for the Fifth Dimension?
Well, it was more about America, about the United States. We played a lot of college campuses.
Right.
We did a lot of concerts. We got dressed in a lot of sweaty
locker rooms.
Right.
No.
You come in there after a game, after they left from a game, and it would be lit up. You know. but you have to go in there and you get dressed and, you know. Being young, you know, you get past that, you get out there because you're worried about doing the best you can do when you get in front of that audience, you know. We played clubs, but we were out on the road maybe about 7 to 8 months out of the year. We were on the road, I mean, moving constantly.
Okay. We also played Las Vegas.
Yes.
And which a lot of the artists weren't doing, but that was one of the offers that we got, and we ended up playing the main room as one of the opening acts for Frank Sinatra, and that was another way that we were introduced to the country at large. And then we did a number of concerts just around the country, and a lot of riding around on buses.
Right.
Really? Okay. When you're doing if you're opening for Frank Sinatra, I know that we interviewed the Jacksons some time ago on the show, and I know that their experience with doing Vegas was that, you know, they had to sort of expand their repertoire somewhat, do more show tunes, do more
kind of ballads.
Yeah, pretty much. So would you have to change the show specifically for a Vegas audience, or was it pretty consistent? The same show that you would do for colleges, were they the same for Las Vegas or your nightclub act?
We wouldn't do the for colleges. We would do more of our recorded material.
Yeah, right.
Our hit songs that were recorded material. Then we would mix up our show with songs that were high rhythm, high energy, and Billy would get out there and start singing a lot of his soul things, and Florence and I would be there dancing and shaking.
Right.
It changed. It depended upon where we were working. We would change it.
But for Vegas, we would do more of a production kind of a show. You know, we would put some production quality into the show, like a song that we did called Ode to Billy Joe. You know, and each one of us took a part. So it looked like a theater piece in Vegas, and it kept the audience right there, you know, because they wanted to see what each character was doing, you know.
Right.
And then after that piece, we would come up with one of our hits or something like that, you know, bring them back down to where we at, you know. So, yeah, we would do that.
Also know that you're one of the few acts that, you know, doing a residency on Broadway is usually a special occasion. I mean, it rarely happens now. Like Bruce Springsteen had a one-man show recently before the pandemic on Broadway. But you guys were definitely one of the first acts to do like a residency there. Well, I think I'm trying to lead up to why you two were so natural when you guys got your own variety special in terms of like doing more than just performing your songs. Like jokes would be, you know, in the show and little sketches and whatnot. Like, did that prepare you for that, especially with when you did your Broadway residency? Or
we had a wonderful man by the name of Rene DeKnight who worked with the group and helped. He taught us a lot about the entertainment business and about what made shows work. And we would get together and come up with songs that. Rene came up with the idea of Ode to Billy Joe. You remember that?
Oh yeah, he was the one.
He was the one who realized that there were five characters and that in the song, and that and we were able to put those five characters together and do that song. And he had been with a group called the Delta Rhythm Boys, who were very, very successful in Europe. Mm-hmm. And when he came and saw us and saw what we were about, he just felt like he wanted to work with us and teach us some of the things that he knew about how to make live shows really work for your audiences and how to mix the music up. And Rene, we give a lot of credit to Rene for helping to teach us about the business and about how it worked and how to make it work. You know, when you talk about when we did that residency on Broadway.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, right. We were working with a dancer. His name was JoJo Smith.
You remember JoJo Smith?
Can't say I've heard of him. No.
Okay. Well, JoJo Smith had a dancing company, and one of the members of his dancing company was a young woman by the name of Debbie Allen.
Oh. Hey.
Wow.
And that was how we met Debbie. And when we did our residency, we were on Broadway for a month, and we had came up with the idea of having a dancing company be our opening for the show, because again, it was a nice balance and a difference of entertainment, and it made for a very entertaining show. And what we did on Broadway. That was
was our beginning of Broadway.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it was.
Ah, I see.
Can I just ask, I just wanted to know how you guys figured out your like physical aesthetic, like for your live shows, for your album covers, like what was the decision behind the outfits and how everything would come together?
Well, you know, when it came to our live shows, we were known for wearing these different type of outfits, you know, right from the beginning. I mean, you know, they dress us funny, you know, but they would dress us in the same colors, but more to our personalities, you know.
So what was your color? What was your color, Billy?
Outfit would be a little different.
Yeah.
And that was our theme, you know. And then all of a sudden, they got a little bit more sophisticated as we stayed into the business more longer, you know, they became sleeker and, you know, different colors like that. Then they would put those on album covers, and I guess the record company would say, hey, you know, put it on the album cover, because if they see an album, they'll know it's the fifth dimension.
Oh, okay. I would love to say that, you know, the idea for that of dressing in different in the themes was actually Lamont's, mm-hmm. Lamont McLemore. Because one time we were getting ready to work in a club in LA, mm-hmm. and the group was not
known
famous at that time. Mm-hmm. And so we had this job, but we didn't have any outfits. And so it was like, oh my God, what are we gonna do? So yeah. Lamont came up with this idea. He said, hey, well, everybody has got something black and white,
yeah,
in your closet. So why don't we take an outfit and everybody wear black and white, and you just wear whatever you want to wear. And that was what we did. We worked that night at that club, and we all had on black and white. And there was a guy in the audience by the name of Boyd Clopton, and he was a designer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And he came backstage afterwards and he said, I love your idea.
Yeah.
You know, you took this theme about black and white, but you each wore your own personalities.
Right.
And he said, I would love to try to design something for you. He said, would you let me design an outfit using that kind of idea? And that was how that evolved.
And he would come up with sketches and different things like that and show them to us before he would make them, you know?
Yeah.
We would okay them.
And each outfit would be more in keeping with the personality of the singer.
Wow. How long did he stay with you guys with making that?
Well, it was about,
Boyd was with us for a long time.
About 7-8 years.
At least. Yeah.
Actually, I'm glad you asked that. Like, I always wanted to know.
Oh, yay.
Well, I love your questions.
You know, there were so many amazing things that happened. The people that we met, the people who became involved with the group, the people who crossed our paths. And it was truly, I feel like the fifth dimension was truly blessed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I always wanted to know. Okay, so I know, again, in today's, the times that we live in today, there are entourages, there's, you know, assistants, there's wardrobe people, there's blah, 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 blah. But I know that at least back then, it was sort of like self-contained and artists were responsible for their own outfits and whatnot. So when you are extensively touring and you have these outfits and whatnot, like how's the upkeep? Like, are you guys the ones that have to iron your stuff before the show, run to the cleaners in between cities and whatnot? Like, or was there a wardrobe person on detail?
No, we there's no way could we had done what we were doing, because we ended up having to take a wardrobe person with us on the road, you know.
Oh.
And they took care of all of, while we were doing our sound checks and getting into the theaters and different things like that, they were backstage taking the outfits out of the trunk and
steaming them,
so you guys were high level. Okay, I get it.
Hell yeah.
James Brown show, they did their own stuff.
To that point, was there ever pressure on you, Marilyn and Florence, to make sure that y'all looked as amazing as y'all did in these outfits?
Well, we would sit in that mirror and make sure we looked the best.
They were under a little pressure there.
But I mean, not to make iron the dresses and iron the guys.
No, I meant to look good in the outfits. Not to, yes, yes, that's what I meant.
Well, we tried our best, and of course, with Boyd coming in with his ideas of, you know, looking at our bodies and trying to figure out what's going to work best on our bodies.
Right.
You know,
well, that's the great part about having a designer, because they fit the outfit to your body.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I'm learning. Yeah. That's a grown up thing, learning about tailors and whatnot, and having things.
Grown up. That's great, man.
No, you're right, Amir.
Yeah, it's great. Wait. Okay. I know. Okay, so I know that Laura Nero wrote the song, but I always wanted to know, and you know, I've seen you guys perform it millions of times on the show and whatnot. But the significance of Wedding Bell Blues and its popularity, I'm certain that you guys always get asked, like, was this song just a platform for Merlin to put Billy on the spot about marriage and whatnot, even though I believe you guys were probably married at the time.
We were
69 married. Is when that came out, so it was the same year.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, whose idea was it to do that song and the whole Marry Me Bill and all those things? Like, because it was kind of unheard of at the time where it's in reverse and the woman is asking the man to... For, you know,
when you gonna get to
marriage.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Laura Nero wrote that for a bill in her life.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
I thought you customized it just for your. I didn't realize that. Okay.
No, actually, you know, she wrote it and she released it as a single, and it did well in California, but not across the country. Because Bones Howe, our producer, came to us with the idea of, you know, Billy and I were going together. Mm-hmm. And he thought, oh, how cute it would be for Marilyn to sing Wedding Bell Blues to Billy. So, and we said, but Bones, it's already been out and it wasn't a hit. He said, no, it wasn't. He said it was a hit in California. He said, but it wasn't a hit across the country. Mm-hmm. So we went in and recorded it and put it on the album, and it ended up being picked as one of the singles.
Wow. I see.
Now, I read in another interview that you two did that Marilyn, you were the one that was actually a little skittish about marriage, but Billy was all in. Is that true?
Yeah, I was all into it. You know how many bills that I've met since we got married?
Man, for real.
Because you guys were bandmates before you became married, was there ever a thought of this might be a conflict of interest? Like, if you're dating now, then if we break up, then is it going to be awkward in the group? Like, what was the awkward factor? Because, I mean, you guys have been in the band since 65, but you got married in 69. Like, what eventually led to that marriage? How do you maintain a business relationship and, you know, keep the marriage happy, so to speak?
Answer that.
Well, no, I need tips.
Billy and I started becoming friends.
That's right.
When we would go to rehearsal together, and we spent a lot of time driving back and forth to rehearsal, and not only that, but after rehearsal, sometimes we go to parties, and Billy and I found ourselves spending a lot of time with each other, just talking and laughing and talking about our lives and, you know, how we felt about music and how we wanted to sing all of our lives.
And what we wanted to do in life and, you know, just sharing it with each other, our dreams, you know, and our passions. But we would be at parties and the party would be jumping and Marilyn and me, we'd be sitting on the couch talking. People must have thought we were a little weird. You
know? That's good stuff. No, that's good stuff right there.
That's love.
We were just into ourselves, you know. And we've been like that ever since, you know. So
we were friends.
Yeah.
And then when we started really kind of realizing that it was developing into something more than friendship, we kind of thought, we said to each other, are we going to mess this up?
Now, this is a dangerous thing to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to mess this thing up because, you know, you can create a mess in the group that's going strong. You know, all we need is a big argument, you know, it's anything crazy, and it's over, you know. But
by that time, we couldn't stop.
No, our friendship was stronger than anything else.
Yeah, you know? My parents had been married for 24 years and then they got a divorce. And I thought, I don't know, this marriage thing is just kind of scary.
Right.
But you know, on the other hand, yeah. I wasn't worried about it because my parents had been married for 68 years.
Wow.
From now on, you know.
That's a lot of pressure on your kids.
It is. I was curious to know how y'all keep from, say, if y'all have an argument or disagreement about something in the studio, over something musically or something in your career, how do you keep those disagreements in your personal, in your professional life from bleeding over into your personal life?
But that's a good question. You know, very good question, because those things have happened, you know, but when they do happen, we have to realize that that's a moment. That's a moment in time. Those things happen to people who are in the industry, especially people who work together. You know, there have been times when things has happened for one and hasn't happened for the other. You just have to live with that. You know, most of all, you have to be thankful. The easiest way to get over that is be thankful for that one that's getting it. Mm. You know, and then you can get over it right quick being thankful.
Did it always come that easy to y'all? Figuring that part out? Okay.
Well, you know, like sometimes before we'd go on stage, Billy and I would be angry. We'd be locked in battle before we went out on stage.
Oh, yeah. Right. But then how do you sing Wedding Bell Blues to him? Because I know.
And you want to kill him.
I know that song is such a staple for your careers, and you have to sell it. Like, you're singing to him and he's doing the acting, whatever. Like, if there's an argument that happens, how do you sell that song?
Well, you know, you can't take that out on the stage.
No, you can't.
And so I'd say, you know, we're not finished. We're going to finish this.
You know, that's always the word. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, we will, you know. When you get out on stage and start singing, it disappears.
You can't sing and be angry.
Yeah, right.
Mm. But could you be angry afterwards? Like, if you had done all that on stage, like, could you get back to that afterwards?
Wow. Marilyn said yes.
Yes.
Boy,
very
wait.
Easy.
Bill, I can't wait till we do the new edition episode because I got a story for you for that.
As soon as the show was over, I was like, now we got to get back into this. And then you get backstage and you say,
what are we working on?
I don't even remember.
Yeah. Because I work with my girlfriend. It's the same thing. Like, I don't know. What were we arguing about?
And then you forget about, you know, hey, it wasn't that big anyway. You know?
Yep.
Most of the arguments that couples have are petty. They really are. But until you think about it, once the argument's over and you get away from it and you think, well, what was that about? Why did I do that? It didn't mean nothing. If I could have only thought about that before we got into it. But a lot of times our egos won't let us do that. So we've got to carry it out. Mm. Yeah. We can win the battle, but you might lose the war.
Wise words.
Write that down.
Wise words. Okay.
Hallelujah.
Amen.
But in a group, from a group standpoint, and it's five of you, how are you guys able to, like, is it all of us have to be unanimous in deciding on something? Like, how are sort of decisions made for songs or album titles, or, you know, can we make this gig? Like, is it democracy, or is it like, is there someone that actually is the alpha leader of the group that makes this decisions for the hard things?
No, it's a democracy.
Yeah. You know, we used to laugh about, we'd say we met more than the UN.
Yeah. Right. Because it was definitely a democracy. I mean, we agreed the one who, the majority who came up with it, that was the way we went, you know. Yeah, we talked about all of our jobs, you know. We agreed to disagree, whatever, yeah.
But most of the time, like with the things that pertain to the career part, like with the title of the album and what were the songs, the final songs that were going to be on the project, most of the time the record company would make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, we would work on it, and then we'd say, you know what, we're not record, you know, we don't know how to run a record company. Right. We know how to make the music and let them choose what's gonna sell.
Well, that was probably the best way for the group anyway, because putting all five people together talking about which one is the best one out there, you know, then the fight started.
I see.
Yeah, we don't want that, yeah.
Well, so that leads me to 1975. What was the process of you two leaving the group and going duo?
Well, you know, that was a tough decision.
Okay.
Very tough for us, because remember, all three of the guys from St. Louis, I mean, we were like family. We knew each other when we were kids, you know, mm-hmm. and kind of migrated to Los Angeles at different times and ended up being in a group. And so, and meeting Marilyn and Florence and being a part of the family. So we were like a family, but we were a family who had dreams. Mm-hmm. It's like any family, it's somebody who have dreams. Like my whole dream was to come out was to be a solo singer with Motown, you know, right. But Marilyn's dream was to be a solo singer with whatever recording come that she could get with that would receive her as a solo singer, you know, okay. a mm-hmm. pop singer. But, so we thought about it, and after 10 years, we thought, will we ever fulfill the dream that we really started with? You know, will we be the ones to come up with the saying that said, if I had only, I shoulda, woulda, shoulda, mm-hmm. I shoulda.
Shoulda, coulda, woulda. Mm-hmm.
You know, you always have it in the back of your mind. Could we have done this on our own? You know? So we decided, and then at the particular time, there was everybody in the group wanted to do more. You know, so right. that thing was happening, you know, so we decided, well, you know, it's about time for us to kind of strike out on our own and see what we can do ourselves.
Did you guys still maintain the friendship after you guys left the group in 75?
Yeah, yes, we did.
It took a couple of years before we, you know, because there were hurt feelings which was understandable.
We could understand that.
But we're very close as family now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, okay. We got Wait, through that. Because
who are the still surviving members? Just who's still surviving along with you guys of the group? Is everyone still alive?
Not everyone. Ron Townsend has passed away.
Oh, AKA the big one.
The one with the beard. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
He passed away. And all the rest, the other four are still living.
That's what's Ron up.
Is alive. In fact, we talked to her a day or so ago. And Lamont is staying in Las Vegas. We talked to him not too long ago. So we're still very close. We're very close. Yeah.
Okay. I have one Fifth Dimension question that actually has to do with when you guys left the group.
Okay.
But I'm hoping you can answer this for me because it's been killing me. Okay. So this came out when I was 5 years old. So I really, even though I kind of had an adult's knowledge of music at the age of five. Uh-huh. This always killed me. Am I dreaming, or did the Fifth Dimension actually have a version of Love Hangover before Diana Ross did? Because I could have sworn I've seen them on American Bandstand doing Love Hangover.
You're right.
And I was just confused at the time, and it's almost like I didn't hear of it. Am I dreaming of that, or?
This was after Billy and I had left the group.
Yeah, after you left. I was just hoping you might know the answer to that.
Okay, right, yeah. We're going to give you the answer.
Yes.
So I wasn't dreaming. Okay.
No. You mentioned did have a version of Love Hangover, and Florence sang the lead on it.
Uh-huh. Right.
And they released it as a single.
Right.
But right around the same time, Motown decided to release Diana Ross's version of Love Hangover,
right?
And that's why you were confused as a child, because you said, "Wait a minute, now."
So, I knew I wasn't crazy.
It doesn't sound too different.
Singles,
yes.
Oh, you're listening to it, right?
Yeah.
Wait, why didn't I just bother to?
It's on yo, Amir, it's on YouTube. Yeah. Sorry.
Wait a minute. I'm asking that question, and I was like, never once did it occur to me to.
Yeah.
Never once did it occur to me, why don't you just YouTube or Google it?
You're learning, Amir, one day.
No, that's dope. You're going to the source. Why not?
No, but I was saying, like I remember them doing it on American Bandstand. I remember my mom really loving that song when they did it. And I remember them doing it a few times on like variety shows. And then, like, yeah, when I was in first grade, like a year, when I was six, then suddenly, like, oh, it was Diana Ross's song. And then in my mind, I was like, wait, was I watching Diana Ross do it the whole time? And maybe not, but I knew, in my mind, I always associated Love Hangover with the Fifth Dimension.
Uh-huh.
I just thought I was
Moans and all though? Is the fifth dimension version with the moans? Y'all could y'all put the moans in there too?
Or? No. I mean,
Okay. I'm sorry. Inappropriate. Excuse me. Sorry.
Okay, so in Going Solo, well, first of all, let it be known that the very first time that I ever saw Jay Leno was on the Billy Davis Jr. Marilyn McCoo show. All right, so for our listeners out there that are listening, can you explain the value or the importance of the variety show in the 70s? Like, I know that now we live in a reality show kind of environment, but when I was growing up, I remember like Gladys Knight and the Pips having a variety show. I remember Flip Wilson, mm-hmm. Tony Orlando and Dawn, like Shields and Yarnell, like everyone had the Jacksons. Everyone had a variety show. What was the, like, was that a desire for you guys, or was it like, this is going to take you guys to the next level? What was the big deal with variety shows?
I think that was the thing to do at that time.
I think that we were basically the first black couple to really have a variety show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the industry, you know, and it was a summer replacement show, and we, mm-hmm. we had six shows to do, and we completed that. And but doing television was good. The only thing that was a bit confusing for us was having to learn songs so quick, you know, because for television, you have to learn the song almost like that week and then perform it that week, you know. And we used to spend a little bit more time on songs to kind of make those songs us, you know, make it, we could get some meat out of it, you know.
Right.
But that was the only thing. Outside of that, we were ready for it because we enjoyed doing the skits and, you know, all of the funny stuff and the love songs. And yeah, it was good. But that us being the first one, then after that, a lot of these other shows started coming on.
Yeah. But like you were saying about Jay Leno, so what we did with our skits, because you always had to have a little humor in the show.
Right.
And so the idea was, since we had spent so much time on the road, why not make the road experience be part of your humor in the show? And mm-hmm. Jay Leno came along. He was a young, unknown comic at the time. And he ended up playing our tour manager.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. And he would always give you guys like weird assignments that was like,
yes.
Yeah, I remember that.
We get lost somewhere, you know, on the road. Right.
Yeah, I totally remember that. Yes. And you guys would end the show the same way, right? Like you guys would say goodnight. Like, was it in bed? Like,
yeah,
that was
like, it would be like at the end of the day.
Like,
right.
You know,
like
and
getting
and,
ready to say goodnight to one another, yeah. You know. Singing a love song,
Then
turning out the light, you know.
Yeah. Right. Wait, you said that was only six episodes in the summer?
Yes.
That's so weird. Like, in my mind, I'm thinking like, oh, that was on for like 4 or 5 years.
No.
I mean, we watched it religiously in the house. So, okay. Mm. I see.
That's the power of television because, you know, they can show them over and over and over.
And reruns.
People think that they're happening. It's more than just six, you know.
Are you guys aware of the kind of the status? I'll say that in dancehall reggae culture, I Hope We Get to Love in Time kind of has a different meaning in the islands. Like that song, it's been covered so many times by like various singers in Jamaica. That were you guys even aware of how big that song is over there, or at least the amount of covers? Like, there's at least
no, we had no idea. That's amazing.
We've never heard it. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like a staple. Like that's one of the ballads you have to sing if you're kind of in the. At least around like the early 80s, suddenly there was like just mm-hmm. an onslaught of I hope we get to Love in Time.
No, no idea.
Wow, no, we didn't know it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say that with Your Love and You Don't Have to Be a Star. Was it different, or did you guys at least have more creative control in the songs that you wanted to do outside of the Bell label, where they mostly made the decisions for you? What was the difference in coming to ABC than it was for Bell?
Well, basically, you know, when we were with ABC, Otis Smith was the what do you call this, his position?
A&R?
Yeah, A&R man. And, okay. And when he picked Don Davis to be our producer, Don Davis, he produced I Hope We Get to Love in Time album, but he came to us with a bunch of songs. And You Don't Have to Be a Star was one of them. And quite naturally, when we heard that, we thought, boy, this is clever. You know, what a great saying. Mm-hmm. Hey, man, you don't have to be a star to be in my show, you know. And it just seemed to fit, you know. But we always thought that I Hope We Get to Love in Time would be the statement that we wanted to make, because Marilyn and me are known for the love songs, you know. And come to find out that You Don't Have to Be a Star was the major hit.
Was the hit, yeah.
And then behind that became another hit was Your Love.
Yeah, Your Love and your little gospel riffs at the end of it. I used to sing that a lot in second grade, sorry. Do you remember at all? I'm a big fan also of Frank Wilson. His production work, especially what, you know, he worked on, like a lot of Eddie Kendricks's solo stuff.
Yes.
He was the prime producer. What was it like working with Frank Wilson?
Frank was a good friend.
Yes. Frank was not only a good friend, but, you know, Frank ended up becoming a preacher, a pastor.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
Yes. He was very instrumental in Marilyn and me becoming Christians, you know?
Oh, and okay.
That was his assignment, I guess, in his life to bring as many entertainers to Christ as he could. And that was a good thing for us, you know, because it's one of the things that really kept us even closer than what we really are.
All right.
Is our love for our faith, you know. But Frank was the producer of the Two of Us album that we did. And we found out later on that there was a song on that album called Wonderful.
Right.
And it was more of an R&B flavor, you know, kind of song. And we found out that song was a major hit in Germany. We never even knew it.
Oh, really?
No, okay. We never knew it. We were on a ship doing a cruise, and this German guy was on had come. And he asked us, he said, "You guys going to sing Wonderful?" We looked at him like he was crazy.
And you had no idea.
We had it in our show. We hadn't even thought about it, you know. He said, "Yes, a big hit in Germany, big hit."
Wow. But one of the fun things about working with Frank was that we all loved picking unusual songs. And Frank brought some unusual songs to us, and things that we found fun to do and kind of wacky, kind of different. We didn't end up with a hit with them.
No.
But we had a good time doing those songs.
A good time singing those songs because they were different.
Yes.
You know, they were different. But the one love song that we did love was...
Saving All My Love for You.
What is it?
Oh, now I was going to ask about Saving All My Love for You. I know that you guys had that first before Whitney Houston did.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
And yeah, like how did you guys come across that song?
Oh my gosh. Michael Masser wrote the song. And oh gosh. Now you got me on that one. I don't remember how that song was brought to us. Do you remember?
Yeah, I think we ran into Michael Masser
somewhere,
and he wanted to produce us.
And he wanted us to do the song.
And he wanted us to do that song and another song that I did. I forgot the name of it. It's so long. but the song was My Reason to Be Is
My
You.
My Reason to Be Is You. That's Frank's song on the Two of Us album.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
We always thought that was one of the greatest love songs that we had recorded, you know.
But Saving All My Love for You. Wow. Yeah. We went into the studio with Michael and Whitney turned that song out.
Yeah.
Yes.
To say the least.
She did a beautiful job on that. Yeah.
Well, of course, you know, it of course we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that Marilyn Monroe, I guess around 82, 83, replaced Dionne Warwick as the host of Solid Gold.
I was waiting for Solid Gold. Thank you. I knew he was going there. Okay. Solid Gold. Yes.
Could you talk about the experience of how that came to be? And I mean, you know, that was such a legendary show. And at the time when you were hosting, practically any artist worth their weight in gold. I mean, even Prince, who's notorious for snubbing shows, like, had to do Solid Gold twice. So what was that whole experience like?
I enjoyed it. Of course, Dionne did it for the first year. Dionne and
Andy Gibb.
It was Dionne and Glenn Campbell that did, I think they did the first year. I think they did they introduced the show, but then I don't know what happened with Dionne and Glenn, but Dionne ended up hosting the first year.
Right.
And then after that, I don't know the inner workings because I came in after all of that was going on, and the producers had decided that they wanted Andy Gibb
to be the
host. And then they thought about combining. They liked the idea of Dionne and Glenn. They liked the
male and female.
Right.
Right. Male, female. And anyway, so they auditioned me with Andy, and they liked the combination. And so I ended up doing that first year with Andy, and they liked it. But at the end of the first year, Andy moved on. He was having some issues.
Right.
And so then I ended up doing this. I don't need to take you through each.
No. I mean, that's
okay. I get
it. No, we're here for it. Yeah.
The Rick Smith and I co-hosted the show this next year.
Smith or Rick Dees?
No, Rex.
Rex. Oh, Rex. You're right. Yeah. Rex Smith. Yes. I totally forgot about that. Okay.
Until later. Yeah.
Right.
So then Rex and I did it the second year. And then the third year, they were trying to decide who I should work with on the third year. And then they decided that they would just go with me.
Wow. And
so then I was with Solid Goal for those next 3 years.
That's the only years I remember.
Yeah, the only years I watched. Yeah.
Well, because y'all were children, babies.
Oh. Yeah.
What was the scheduling into? Because, I mean, because they were celebrating the charts, was it all year round or was it like seasonal?
Yeah, it was seasonal. We would do the shows. We would tape every other week, and we would go with the charts and what was big at that time. And we would tape Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then the following week would be off. I'd go out and work. Billy and I would go out and work, and then I'd come back and we'd
do some
feature the next the songs that were popular then. And that was the way.
I see.
Yeah.
So, but it was basically just, it was a good experience in doing that.
I enjoy that a lot because like you said, everybody came on and did the shows, and you know, I remember when Madonna came on,
right.
And of course I remember Prince being there, and I didn't get a chance to really spend any time with Prince because he was kind of shy.
Yeah.
but still, it was a lot of fun. And the dancers, of course, were just amazing.
I was going to say, how nice was Darcell Wayne? She was sort of like a unicorn in that, you know, probably next to Sheryl Song on Soul Train, Darcell Wayne was probably the most popular dancer on Solid Gold, but you never heard of anything of her in the press or anything. So it's just like this woman with this beautiful long hair on the show. And then I didn't hear much from her afterwards. Like, was she, what was she like?
Still out there. She's dancing.
Right.
And I haven't seen Darcell in quite a while, but she was a pleasure to work with, and she was just beautiful.
Yes.
Just awesome to watch. I mean, her dancing was just amazing. And I enjoyed the experience.
I enjoyed it too, because I got a chance to be on the show quite a few times myself.
Right.
Those are the advantages.
Yes. Billy would come on and we would sing our duets together.
Oh, yeah,
I love that.
Right.
I always enjoyed that.
Yeah, it should also be noted that Casper, even though Jeffrey Daniels sort of gets the glory for teaching Michael Jackson how to do the moonwalk, it was actually Casper who was a dancer on Solid Gold that really, you know, taught Michael the aesthetics on how to do the moonwalk. He was also.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Is that right?
Okay. Well, I didn't even know that. Wow.
I'm impressed by your knowledge of the Solid Gold dancers. This is amazing.
I'm a wealth of useless knowledge right now.
Right now? Like this moment, right now?
Only for this specific moment.
No.
So I also wanted to know, I know that you guys went through to your gospel phase shortly thereafter. In the mid to late 80s and in the 90s, I recall, I believe you guys, as the Fifth Dimension, reunited. What was that process like in reuniting the group, and how was it?
There was a special
moment
I think that says it all.
Okay.
First time we got back together, and we started talking about we were going to do this reunion tour. And we said, well, first of all, let's see where we are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we hadn't sung any harmonies together in many years. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, we had gotten away from that, so we weren't remembering the harmonies so well.
Right.
And so we got around the piano and they said, let's start out with Up, Up and Away, which is unison. Mm-hmm. And everybody remembers that. And we started to sing, would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? And our voices, the blend, we all started looking at one another and saying, oh my gosh.
That's right.
Still there.
Still got it.
It was like we never walked away from each other. You know, it was the same sound. They'd say, wow, this is amazing, you know?
It was very emotional.
And then the democracy started again, you know. You know, we started getting together and doing jobs, but it was set up the way we had it set up with the Fifth Dimension before we left. Yeah.
Wow. So how long did the reunion tour last for?
What did we do? 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah, a couple of years. We did some performances together, and then... And Billy and I still had some of our duet shows that we had to do. Mm-hmm. And Florence and Lamont and Ronald had two other members in the group, and they had their performances. So they had bookings, we had bookings. Mm-hmm. But then we would come together and do some original, we would call it the original Fifth Dimension.
Yeah.
And, and work for different companies, and they would... It was considered like a very special occasion to have the original Fifth Dimension back.
During that time, they called them corporate jobs.
Yeah.
You know, we played a lot of corporate jobs.
Trust me, that still exists.
And it's also kind of dope that y'all could agree on that whole original dimension versus the other dimension and let them do their own thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it weird for you to see... Because even way into the 80s, I kept seeing, you know, like Florence would have another lineup long after Ron and Lamont left the group. Was it kind of weird sort of seeing at least the name still carrying on without the four original members in the group for you guys?
It was, it was different. It was kind of weird, it sounded different, you know, to us. I mean, to the audiences.
To us too. I'll say it for you. It sounded weird to us too.
Well, you know, not only that, we would, when we would, could, we would go and see them and support them and be there for them, you know?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I see. Also, we should mention, what was it like playing, I'm a big fan of the original Jamie Foxx show.
Yes.
I know that, you guys were Fancy's parents.
His parents.
Yes.
We enjoyed that so much. That was a great group of people to be working with.
Oh, yeah.
The producers. Yeah. Jamie was delightful. And we got a kick out of that.
Oh, yes. You know, Jamie is so talented. My God. I mean, just to see him work and the stuff that comes off the top of his head. I mean, he's just, he's a creator.
Oh,
you know, it just comes out of him, you know.
They might need a song for a special moment in the show. And so then they would say, oh, we need a song here. And Jamie would go off somewhere and he'd come back.
And he'd have a song.
With a brilliant song.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's good. So I'll say that. I'm sorry. We got to mention Blackbird. What was the sort of the idea in covering Lennon McCartney songs for the Blackbird project, especially in light of when it was and why it was released last year or this year? Well, it came out.
It just came out.
Earlier this year. You recorded it last year, though. What was the significance behind, or at least the process in recording that album?
Well, our management company, we had been talking about a project. A young man by the name of Nick Mendoza had been introduced to us, and our management company thought that he would be a wonderful producer to work with. And now Nick is a millennial producer.
Yes.
So a very young. But he came to us with a very, interesting knowledge of the two of us.
Who we were.
Our voices, our sounds. And we started talking about ideas, and we were very concerned and troubled by what's been going on in our country.
Right.
And we felt like, if we're going to do something, we want to do something that speaks to what is going on right now.
Right.
As we told Nick how we felt and what we would love to do, Nick was very, very much interested, because he said, well, you know, you guys are talking about the things that people my age are worried about.
Right.
You know, about what's happening to our country and why, you know, why are we so at odds and.
What is the division about,
yes.
You know? It's not young people don't haven't lived what we have lived, but they still want to know what it's all about. And we had been doing Blackbird and having a Beatles medley in our live show.
Right.
And so we were familiar with Blackbird and what it meant, because Lennon and McCartney wrote it as an anthem, the civil rights anthem, you know. Mm. And so we just said, hey, this is really a movement, you know, it's a civil rights movement is the way we looked at it,
yes.
You know, because everybody needs to know what's going on out here, you know? So
right.
We decided to go ahead and start putting Blackbird in, and we started listening to more of the Beatles songs and started putting stories kind of like behind these songs, like Ticket to Ride with Rosa Parks, man, when she wouldn't give up her seat on the bus, and she just, you know, and her being going to jail and her husband waiting for her, you know, and you don't know the story about her husband.
Mm, really don't.
No.
That was another story, you know. So Blackbird is in the front of the album, portrays all of the the people who were killed and just for no reason at all, you know, just because of their color. And it's created a lot of division in our society. And we just pray that this album will be a healing project.
We were so inspired and encouraged by the young people and how they were coming together and protesting together, you know, across racial lines, across cultural lines. And we're saying that this is what our country needs. We've got to come together. We've got to draw together and make the statement understood and heard. And we just felt like we want, like you said, we wanted to make it like a movement. And that's
a human rights movement.
Right. Well, congratulations for another number one album on the R&B charts. That's pretty great.
Excited about the response that we've been seeing because, I mean, you know, at this age, for us to be doing this now is just amazing.
Well, you know, it's your time.
Quest, love, you had a lot to do with that, with finding this footage.
The footage,
On Summer of Love, just like you created a renaissance for us.
Yes, you have.
We thank you, man. You're a star.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it.
You're a star in our show.
In your show, absolutely. No, I will say that probably, you know, one of the key scenes that's in the movie that really touched people, like when they tell me how much they loved it, especially for like fellow black artists that I show it to. First of all, just watching you two watch it, I couldn't have scripted it better. You know, it couldn't have happened more pitch perfect, note perfect than your interview portion, especially, you know, letting the sentiments be known how important playing that festival was and connecting with black audiences that otherwise might not have been familiar with you guys at the time.
That's right.
How it really, really touched them. And I will say that, you know, I should be thanking you because I mean, you know, it's the footage itself is magic on its own, but you guys really humanized it and really touched people's hearts with your portion of that movie. And I thank you both.
Wow.
For doing that.
It was such a special, special moment.
What you put together was beautiful. I mean, that's the only way we can react to it. I mean, it's just what comes from the heart goes to the heart, you know?
Amen. And we were so happy for you to win that grand jury prize from Sundance, the festival. We were just so excited that happened, you know, because and your premiere, this is your first directorial experience, and come up with such a powerful success like this, and we're just so excited for you.
Flowers, man, somewhere for over 50 years, and all the stars that were on that footage is just.
I ask myself that all the time, but you know, now's the time. Like I feel like, you know, it's 50 years.
You just took a whole compliment. I am sitting here floored. You did not interrupt them. You let them tell you all the fabulous things about you.
You only looked uncomfortable
just let them know
for a second.
I'm world famous for avoiding compliments. I hate compliments. I'm sorry.
Right.
You're good.
I just got to take it or else they'll tease me about it.
Yes.
Flowers.
Wait, before I wrap up, there is one question I got to ask only because the sample is so famous. I know that, Billy, you started your own independent label sometime in the mid-70s, and one of your clients, one of the acts on the label was Jimmy Castor Bunch.
Yes.
What was that experience like? Only because on that particular album,
Just Begun,
was a famous not Just Begun. On
Hurt the Butt, or was it?
No, Kanye's
I wanna know
the first song on Graduation.
Graduation. Good morning.
It's the intro.
Yeah, it's it's Jimmy Castor's cover of "I Just Want to Stop" by Gino Vannelli. It's on the label that
and tell you how Billy I feel headed. About
What was working with Jimmy Castor like during that period, and what made you want to start your own label during that period?
Well, it was I've always wanted to produce and create my own kind of way in life, and at that particular time, Jimmy's sister Linda was working for our company, you know.
Oh, okay.
She was telling us about Jimmy, and when we met him, it was like family. I mean, he was just a regular guy loving his music, and you know, so we just got into it and say, let's get busy with some music, you know.
I see.
Everything that you hear on that album, that's all Jimmy.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, you guys, I mean, it goes without saying that you guys are a class act, and I really, 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 really thank you for giving us your time and coming on the show. And I just love you guys to death.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a
genuine fan of the group.
For real.
Well, thank you.
You guys are an inspiration also, especially in a time period which...
How you're such a serious historian.
Yes, right.
That is your heart. And, you know, when you meet somebody like that, you want to share with them all the knowledge that you have to contribute
I'm avoiding the
compliments are overloaded.
Messing us up, you know.
I'm not a historian. I'm just a really, really, really big Billy Davis and Merle McCoo fan.
Nice. Good answer.
I thank you guys for it. And, you know, much continued success. Maybe my last question is, what do you want the legacy of Billy Davis and Merle McCoo to be?
Wow. Our legacy.
Well, you know, I know... It's just that people coming together and just being who we are to one another, not being putting on or trying to be more than what we are. Just be who you are, right. And just people coming together on one accord. You know, if we can just do that and have our human rights, yes. That would be a legacy for me. Before I leave here.
Wow. That's a mic drop right there.
Yeah, I was just about to say drop it.
That's a mic drop right there. Well, thank you very much for doing the show. I love and appreciate you guys. On behalf of Laia and Unpaid Bill and Sugar Steve and Von Tigolo, this is Questlove. I cannot believe I got to talk to Billy Davis and Merle McCoo. Thank you very much. This is Questlove Supreme. We'll see you on the next program.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.